Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, seeing as there's not much going on down here in the States, perhaps it's a good time to check in with the lives of our neighbors to the north. Toronto-based author Sachi Kuhl was in town recently for a chat with Seattle writer Lindy West. Kuhl had never been here before. She was looking forward to trying some clam chowder, for some reason, and seeing Frasier's apartment from the TV show. She'd apparently seen every episode, having watched regularly as a child with her father. West broke the bad news about where Frasier was actually filmed, and Kuhl recovered quickly from her disappointment. Sachi Kuhl is a culture writer for BuzzFeed and other publications. Her parents immigrated to Canada from India. She writes frankly and often sharply about her life experiences and opinions, and has paid the price to a frightening extent via Twitter troll harassment. Her first book is a collection of 10 essays titled, One Day We'll All Be Dead and None of This Will Matter. In it, she turns reflections on family, cross-cultural issues, gender, sexism, racism, rape culture, and body image into an alternately funny, pointed, and affecting commentary on Western culture. Sachi Kuhl read from her work and spoke to Lindy West at Seattle Public Library's Central Library on May 31st. Please note, this recording contains unedited language of an adult nature. We're presenting our podcast version here. You'll find the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, the Elliott Bay Book Company's Karen Maeda Allman introduces Sachi Kuhl.
Hello, I'm Karen Maeda Allman from Elliott Bay Book Company. So thanks so much for coming tonight to see two women who have been setting the internet on fire. So tonight we have Sachi Kuhl and Lindy West. Sachi Kuhl is based in Toronto and is a culture writer for BuzzFeed. You've seen her work on Jezebel and The New Yorker and in newspapers such as The New York Times, The Globe and Mail, and of course you've seen her on Twitter. So most people here have seen her on Twitter, right? Okay. She's here to promote her new book, One Day We'll All Be Dead and None of This Will Matter, a hilarious and thoughtful collection of essays written from the point of view of a first-generation Canadian woman with roots and parents from Kashmir. She takes on topics such as family and those ideas and customs that don't really translate so well after you've located yourself thousands of miles away from your parents' cultures. Also about losing your language, colorism, a rape culture, Twitter trolls, and so much more. I think it's essential reading. And I'd say it's about time for a voice like hers. So after she does a little talk at the podium, there will be an onstage conversation with Seattle's own Lindy West. And her work, of course, figures on pop culture, social justice, humor, and body image. She's a culture writer for GQ Magazine and GQ.com, and also her articles appear frequently in The Guardian. And her book is Shrill. And as Linda said, we do have copies of both Shrill and also One Day We'll All Be Dead, None of This Will Matter at the Elliott Bay Table. So after the conversation with Lindy, then there'll be an opportunity for audience questions. So with that, thanks for coming, and please join me in welcoming Sachi Kuhl.
You guys, the fucking consulate is here. And I told my dad, if you've read the book or if you have the book and you've looked at it, or if you follow me on Twitter, you might be very familiar with my father, who's extremely invested in my life, unfortunately, about the consulate coming. And he, like, didn't care. And I was like, it's a brown lady. And then he cared, like, big time. So that's something that happened today. So I'm going to read a little something from a chapter called Size Me Up. There are obviously many serious themes in this book, but I'm going to read about my garbage body. Around the age of 10, I gained a significant amount of weight, the kind that family members stop referring to as cute or baby weight and start referring with a heavy sigh. There was, in reality, nothing wrong with my weight, but I was too young and too insecure, a lethal combination, to know that. So I did what I thought I should. I hid my rapidly developing body. I started wearing bum equipment sweatpants and long-sleeve heat-locking tops. Both items were perhaps utilitarian in the winter, but tended to turn my person into a walking, sweating radiator by June. Shopping was my mother's game. She would return from stores that sold clothes exclusively for hikers, with a wagon full of wool socks and dungarees for her puberty-stricken daughter. Nothing I owned fit anymore, and I didn't trust that buying the right clothes would make me feel better about the way my hips had widened, or my arms had softened, or my neck now had ridges running across it, as if I were an old tree, and these were my rings. At the time, I claimed my style was some kind of feminist protest. I don't need to look like every other girl. Why should I have to dress up when guys can wear whatever they want? That's my feminist voice, by the way. I listened to Avril Lavigne and recited the lyrics as if they were my own thoughts. I watched CNN because I didn't want to be a frivolous teen. I had crushes on adult men like Jon Stewart and Rahm Emanuel, and hot dads at the mall with salt and pepper hair and Palm Pilots. I didn't know what a Palm Pilot was. But in truth, I just didn't know if I was allowed to look like a cute girl, if my body was bigger than the other girls I knew, if my skin was darker, if I was more sullen than sugar. I hid in muted drapery, hoping no one would notice, or better yet, they would assume I was just a very tough, genderless sphere. This crumbled by the time I was 11. A well-meaning woman at my mother's Jenny Craig meeting told her what a precious son she had. I was wearing a baseball cap with the Coca-Cola logo emblazoned on the front, a red puffy vest, and gray sweatpants. It was July. It was embarrassing to be mistaken for a boy. Not a girl with masculine tendencies, not a girl rejecting traditional gender roles, just a boy. I was being defined by my clothing instead of transformed by it. Coincidentally, this was the year I discovered Lord of the Rings weenie Orlando Bloom, a crush that would last 24 months and spawn more than one fan club, my brother being the only member, and by force. Boys don't like girls in promotional hats, and I wanted boys to like me. So I started growing my hair out and asked my mom to take me shopping. I wanted to dress like a girl, and not just a pretty girl, but a hot girl. That poor definition of whatever makes a woman worth looking at, worth touching, at least from a teenage boy's perspective. Clothes, the right clothes, could make me, even me, very hot. Unfortunately, my tastes differed drastically from my mother's. My interests were swaying towards t-shirts with hilarious and racy sayings paired with elastic waistbanded jeans. I wanted to try on belly tops and white belts with big silver bolts. My mom suggested matching stretchy pants and long sleeve tops with watercolor wolves standing near the reflection of the moon in a calm river. T-shirts with little frogs posed on 3D lily pads. Flowing Indian tunics that I could tell were clearly not English clothes, as we called them. Ones in jewel tones and gold stitching that screamed, "My mother is an immigrant and we only eat off metal plates." She'd hold them up and say, "They look so nice." And I'd say, "They're itchy." And she'd say, "How?" And I'd furiously rub the sequins against my skin until I flash red bumps and then say, "See?" A particular fight between my mother and me broke out in the women's aisle at Walmart the summer before I started middle school when I found a royal blue shirt with running across, "If it weren't for boys, I wouldn't even go to school." This was a completely false statement for me to support. I wrote extra credit English essays, joined the school paper, and wept for weeks when my grade 6 yearbook failed to print my future goals next to my school photo, worried everyone would think I was a purposeless hack at 12. I was afraid of the boys who went to my school, all of whom did not like me and were prone to calling me a faggot. But I felt that if I got this shirt, I could transform myself at my new school. I would be cool and elusive and one of those types people refer to as chill. What does that mean? I still don't know, but I want it. Even now, I forever aspire to be chill. I had the whole scene planned out. I would walk into school wearing that shirt, along with a set of earrings from Claire's, the one shaped like lightning bolts to really bring out the yellow in the lettering. I'd pair it with my floor-length patchwork denim skirt with the little Union Jack on the pocket. I did not know the flag's origin, but it's not like there was a class that would teach me like about flags and stuff. Then I would encircle my eyes with thick black liner all the way around, elevating myself from mousy girl to sex raccoon. Graham, the boy I had the hots for, would really see me for the first time. Not as a girl he once tackled in flag football, but as the woman he once tackled in flag football. I would pull my glasses off and the transformation would be complete. Who is this girl? Everyone would ask. It's me, I'd say. The crowd would gasp in amazement, and I would have a million friends and be very thin and rich and filled with an embarrassment of sexual energy for a 13-year-old. Choices, sir. Choices. While I was concocting this elaborate fantasy in Walmart, my mom was explaining to me why she wouldn't be buying the shirt. That's inappropriate, she whispered, as if the words themselves were sinful. My mother had a tendency to slip into outrage and shock as a first reaction to anything. And the lower her voice dropped, the more she was disappointed in me. I could barely hear her. It's not even long enough to cover your tummy, she said, pulling me towards a row of long-sleeved t-shirts that said glam in different colors. I still have that shirt, by the way. It has not aged well. We settled on a short-sleeved number with glittery navy vinyl lettering that proclaimed, I'm not perfect, but I'm so close it scares me. Oh my God, this is so embarrassing. Even though I loved the shirt, so clever, so quietly smart, so, dare I say it, elegantly subversive, I raged at my mom for weeks. She claimed that shirts like the royal blue one were intended for women like my 20-year-old cousin and not for pudgy middle schoolers. But what 20-year-old is shopping at the girls' section at Walmart, mother? It got worse a few days after classes started when my arch nemesis Stephanie wore the shirt I'd wanted, getting an obscene amount of negative male attention. I stomped all the way home that afternoon. That was supposed to be my negative male attention. This thinking, finding an outfit that I believe will revolutionize my existence, is a repeated one of failure throughout my life. There was the pair of faux leather red peep-toe pumps in 2006, the high-waisted oatmeal-colored wide-leg trousers of 2008, the black sequin bolero of 2009, the skin-tight cerise knockoff Hervé Léger bandage dress. This New Year's Eve is gonna be amazing of 2011 that I still own and pull out of my closet now and then to remind myself of what I am not. I still remember my favorite outfit from the 10th grade, a mint green V-neck lace top, dark wash bootcut jeans, and black and teal butterfly Mary Jane kitten heels. The butterflies were 3D. I wore that outfit for every major occasion. When I wanted Drew to ask me out, he did not. When I wanted to ace a math test, I did not. When I wanted to be noticed by an attractive guest speaker, I was not. Despite this piss-poor batting average, I felt a renewed sense of potential every time I put it on. Today, something good has to happen. So nearly a decade after that outfit stopped being a staple in my wardrobe, I yet again fell into the trap of believing cloth could be revolutionary. Walking through Toronto's financial district, I passed a clothing chain known for simple skirts, blouses, blazers, and a terrible roll-on perfume that burned. It was also the second and last retail job I ever had when I was 19 and living in my cousin Angie's basement beside her table saw, which she used to make her hand-carved wizard wands. Yeah, that was a weird one. Should have probably examined that.
I was at least 20 years younger than the clientele that came into the store. I hardly made enough money to buy the $90 cocktail casual dresses on the rack, and I managed to be 20 minutes late for every shift. I wasn't fired exactly, but when I left my section of the store to reapply my $4.50 lipstick and a drunk man managed to swipe $800 of merchandise from the store without being detected, I nobly offered not to return. But that was years ago, and I felt a twinge of self-satisfaction in going back as a customer. So much of my life had changed since I worked there. I wasn't a teenager anymore. I had my own apartment. I had paid all my taxes at least once. I bought shoes in real stores instead of waiting for my older cousins to tire of theirs. The store was little more than a reminder of how far I had progressed in a few short years. "Help me with these buttons, shop girl," I imagined saying, "for I am an important woman. I own a microwave." That said, the real reason I entered the store was far more practical than ego. It was the dead of summer, some 35 degrees Celsius. I don't know how to convert that, and I'm not going to help you. You're going to have to figure that out yourself. And I'm a soggy woman even in the most forgiving conditions. Standing outside the store, I was already sweating in new and interesting parts of my body, and I knew that if I didn't get into a building colder than the surface of the sun, of the moon, my makeup would start bleeding, and I'd look like a wax figurine left in a clay oven. I walked in, relishing the blast of cool air, and immediately saw Aaliyah. She had trained me when I worked there, but was now the store manager and still as tall and stately and glamorous as I remembered her being when I was 19. Best of all, she did not seem to recognize me. I rummaged through sales rack after sales rack, tossing aside shirts that I knew would cling in the wrong places, colors that would bring out the sallow tint of my complexion, and the one-piece jumpers, because inexplicably, adult women are still wearing jumpers. I don't know how they pee. I was older, more mature. I had learned some important lessons, mostly about peeing. But like most of my shopping trips, I grew frustrated quickly. There was little in my size, and the few things that were listed as an 8 or a 10 were really cut for someone who was a 4 or a 6. Just the thought of forcing my wide hips through trousers or my bolder shoulders through a t-shirt felt like more pain than it was worth. And yet, on my way out, I found it. The thing. A black and white fall skirt that I knew would look perfect on me. It was in soft wool, but in a slimming cut, and hit just below the knee. It would be perfect for work, or maybe going out after work, or maybe I would wear it with a big floppy hat and a trench coat at a Parisian cafe, waiting for a parcel from a mysterious stranger. I am Carmen Sandiego in this fantasy, like I am in most of my non-sexual, non-food-related fantasies. I held my breath, turning it over to see the price and the size. It was on sale, and it was an 8. "It's happening," I thought. The item, the big item that changes the way I dress and thereby changes the way I am as a person. It's not just a skirt, it's the entry fee for a better existence. I would exude a new confidence. It would smooth out the wrinkles in my body. It would hide all the ways I have disappointed and failed people in the past. While wearing it, women would approach me and beg me to tell them where I got it. I would act coy and wink to the camera. In this version of the fantasy, I am in like a commercial. And I'd say something like, "I'll never tell," or just something I picked up. People would see me on the street shoving fistfuls of Teddy Grahams in my mouth on the way to the podiatrist, and they'd think, "That lady really's got her life together." That is a lot of pressure for something on sale for $24.99, Canadian, which is like $8 here. I'm so poor. Aaliyah led me into a changing room, complimenting me on my choice. I locked the door and looked at myself in the mirror, taking a deep breath. This could be it. I peeled the shorts off my sweating skin and stepped into the skirt. It slid up my body, resting on my waist, and I pulled the zipper up towards the Lord. It didn't just fit. No, it did more than that. It melded to my body. It was beautiful. As if it had been cut specifically for me to mask and smooth and elevate. I would be better in this skirt. The dream was alive. I had the all-knowing smile. My hair was suddenly more luxurious. I felt thinner, more acceptable. I was a better woman. Girls who had been mean to me in high school would see me in the skirt and think, is that Saatchi? And I'd be like, you bet it is, you dumb bitch. And then I'd punch all their boyfriends. I haven't thought that one out as much as the others, so you're gonna have to bear with me. Conflated imaginings aside, I did look pretty good. I walked out of the changing room to vamp in front of people paid to tell me I look great. The skirt was a little warm for the summer, but who cares? I'd wear it when fall came. I did one more spin in front of Aaliyah and her coworkers before feeling a thick droplet of sweat fall from my brow onto my eyelash. I was overheating in my perfect skirt, so I headed back to the changing room. My hands were sweating too much to grasp the zipper in the back, so I wrapped a t-shirt around my fingers to get a grip, but it would not budge. I sucked in, gathering the fabric, and tried to tug the zipper down. No luck. I struggled like this for a good 15 minutes, the changing room lights feeling more like an interrogation lamp, sweat pooling in the dimples above my ass, my hair matted on my face. I had fallen into this trap before so many times. Years before this, I went through a phase of buying clothes only from vintage stores, beautiful dresses and skirts that required real care and attention that I wasn't willing to give to another person, never mind a chiffon gown. They had no elastic, bled color wherever you sat, with zippers that rusted and fell apart like rotting teeth. My favorite purchase, though, was a cocktail dress. It was a simple blood red shift that came with a layer that slipped on top, a long peplum type that made my waist look really small. I wore it too often, too many places, paired with irrational brown heels. I wore it to school with my hair done and red lipstick, as if at any moment someone would rush into my JRN 121 class and say, help, I'm a very wealthy lawyer and I need an extremely well-dressed young woman to join me on my yacht for a party that might have some influence on making me partner. Also, I'm looking for a wife to politely ignore but who may spend my money freely and maintain multiple quiet affairs with my handsome coworkers. You look ironed, are you interested? But I didn't know how to care for the dress. It had been made in the 50s for a woman an inch or two thinner than me, so I was already testing the tensile strengths of the seams. I hand washed it in cold water. Isn't that what you do with delicate fabric? The dress bleeding out its red color, fading it slightly. But it also shrank somehow, now only reaching halfway down my thigh. It was too much for school. Oh, now it's too much. But fine for any other occasion. Yes, it was so tight that on my ass and my hips that I couldn't sit down in it, but that just meant I'd wear it to run errands. When my cell phone broke and I needed to get it repaired, I wore my favorite dress and brown heels to the mall. Unfortunately, we can't repair any phones that might have been dropped in liquids or foods, and I can see some marinara on the headphone jack is what I ended up hearing that day. But I felt the dress tear right between my butt cheeks. There was no seam there, just a lot of tension. But back in the changing room, I was reaching peak anxiety. I tried pulling the skirt over my head. My waist is smaller than my shoulders, a problem I did not calculate until I almost got my arm stuck in the skirt as well. Then I considered tearing the zipper and telling Aaliyah that it broke while I was trying to disrobe. But I didn't want to ruin such a good item. Maybe it was salvageable. Maybe I could still be the woman I felt I could be. My only options were to ask Aaliyah to help me out of the skirt, or to wear it out of the store, making me the only idiot sweating in a wool skirt in 30-degree heat who isn't also handing out pamphlets that read, "Have you made peace with your God?" Sometimes zippers move if you rub a candle on them. I could run outside and say, "Does anybody have a candle? It is an emergency." That would be fine. I considered a secret third option in that changing room, one where I would type out a quick suicide note on my phone and then use a fabric belt to fashion a trendy noose. But whatever the decision, I needed to make it fast, since soon my whole body would be covered in my salty, sticky shame sweat. I left the changing room and tapped Aaliyah on the shoulder, hoping she wouldn't notice my entire face was glistening. "That does really look great on you," she said, giving me that wide smile I had seen her give so many customers before. "I'm stuck," I said. I turned around my rear towards her as she tried the zipper herself. She tried bunching the fabric to get a better grip. "Suck in," she said, pulling more and more of the skirt towards her. She called over her coworker to help. She too could not manage. "It's so weird," she said. "It's like the skirt is caught on nothing." "No, nothing except my own ego and humiliation. I flew too close to the sun with this one." A third employee came over and tried to use a pin to pull the zipper's teeth apart. She spent a full minute just shaking my hips as if she was trying to will me to a smaller size and the skirt would just slide off. And admittedly, a minute may not sound like a lot of time, but ask a loved one to shake your lower half vigorously for an entire minute, and then tell me how long those 60 seconds feel like. The employees turn to each other and discuss what to do next. "We could rip out the zipper and then sew it back on. Do you think she can pull it over her head or, oh no, her shoulders are too wide. What if we just cut her out?" That last one is the ultimate nightmare. If you are a woman in the audience, you know this to be true. The possibility of getting stuck in a garment at a store where the employees have to cut you out is the beginning of the end of your life. It is like the saddest version of a C-section where the baby is just a half-naked lady with no dignity. "Yeah," Aaliyah said to her cohorts, "grab the scissors, we have to cut her out." It was like listening to three surgeons decide you needed to be sliced in half, thinking you're unconscious and can't hear them. Two women held the skirt to my hips, pressing me into the wall of the changing room hallway. I could see my reflection in the mirror, my face now drenched with sweat. From the outside, I looked like I was being hazed by a group of women far too old to be welcoming in new pledges. But all I was focused on was not exposing my entire lower half to whoever had walked into the store during this ordeal. I said a silent goodbye to my beloved skirt, the garment that was supposed to make me better, but just reminded me that no, you are what you are, even if you remember to iron. "Okay, hold still," Aaliyah said. This was an intimate moment for us. Her face was closer to my butt than anyone had been in, like, hours. We were sisters now. While the other two women flanked me and held the skirt up, Aaliyah pulled the fabric away from my body and started making small cuts. "I don't want to cut you," she said. But at that point, I welcomed any distraction from the sweat gathering on my back like tiny, resplendent pools of my greatest fear come to life. The sound that's made when one cuts a perfectly useful item of clothing is almost painful, especially when it's one you've fallen in love with. All those hems and seams and stitches destroyed so easily. It's the same feeling I imagine that would come if you baked and iced a cake, only to drop it on the way to a birthday. But the sound that's made when someone, say, cuts an item of clothing they weren't supposed to cut is criminal. It's the quietest slap in the face you will ever feel. So when she made her final cut, I turned to Aaliyah to thank her. Maybe I would make a joke about how we had worked together, how I had let all that merchandise just walk right out of the store, and here I was doing it again. But all the color had drained from her face. She had sliced right through my underwear, leaving me exposed like either a confused surgery patient or a very physically confident crazy person. I mean, I'm guessing it was an honest mistake on her part. I was wearing one of those 1999-esque whale tails that were popular amongst high school girls trying to attract boys with the forbidden fruit of tiny underpants. It wasn't so much clothing as it was thickly woven black floss hanging out inside the crevices of my garbage body. Aaliyah wordlessly ushered me back into the changing room, then gave me the scissors, saying I could cut myself out further if I needed to. I tore the skirt right in half, looking at what was hanging off of me in the mirror. One hip wrapped in an elastic band like a still raw roulade, the other naked except for a thick thread swinging purposely by my side. I started to get dressed, trying to see if I could tie my underwear back together or maybe cinch it with the hair elastic I had around my wrist. Instead, I opted to just stuff myself back into my denim shorts. I handed Aaliyah the remains of the skirt and the scissors, apologizing for destroying a perfectly good item of clothing. "Oh, it's okay," she said, "it happens," though she did not clarify to whom else it had happened. I bought that trendy noose belt to compensate. And then, of course, as I shuffled out of the store, I heard Aaliyah proclaim with great zeal, Oh my God, I just remembered where I know her from. The nightmare was over, but I still had to sulk home in a heat wave, my clothes soaked from sweat, my underwear hanging by a single thread. And if you have never experienced the sensation of your naked labia rubbing up against freshly washed denim as you maneuver through a subway car with broken air conditioning, you have had more than your fair share of luck in this life. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. That was amazing. Thank you so much.
Is it?
Hello?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi.
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 Hi. That's it.
Have a good night, everyone. I'm so glad that you're here in Seattle.
Thanks.
I hear that you've never been here before.
I've never been here at all. I haven't really seen much of the West Coast of the States generally.
But
yeah.
You had a special experience today. Which you all probably already know. You had clam chowder for the first time.
First of all, I think it's pronounced chowder. But yes, I did. I had a chowder with bacon in it.
How was it?
It was excellent. It was excellent chowder.
How did you find the texture of the clam? Because I have an issue with it. Also, sometimes, I'm glad that I didn't tell you this before you had your chowder.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes there's a little sand in the clam.
Oh, I didn't find it sandy. I enjoyed the texture of the clam.
Oh, good. There was no sand in yours?
I mean, I feel like the texture's also taken over by the texture of the potato.
Yeah,
which is its own kind of sandiness.
That's true.
This is what the talk is going to be. I'm just going to talk about food. I have lots of food opinions.
I would be happy to talk to
you
about
example,
food.
For example, avocado, gross.
Ooh.
Bad.
Wow.
You know what else? Pie. Disgusting.
I can get with that.
Pie's bad.
I mean, apple pie is fine.
No, hate it. Worst pie.
What?
Worst pie, America. I don't like it.
No, a horrible, tangy, berry
Hot
pie.
Hot stewed fruit. Bad. Bad. I don't get it.
That's ridiculous, but that's fine.
Someone once told me a rumor that apple pie was invented by a Canadian, and it really upset me. Like, put that on me.
That would be a good punishment for you.
I know. We already have a lot.
Horrible opinions.
I can't take any more.
I think lemon meringue is the worst pie. Sorry. Meringue.
All pies that are not savory are bad.
Okay, I'm not going to even get involved.
You can do with that what you will.
It's obviously irrational, but
listen, I don't think a lot of brown people eat pie. You know, we have condensed milk. We just go and get cans of condensed milk and drink them. See, there was like a knowing yes. Who said that? Someone said that. They know. Okay, I've derailed this. I've ruined it.
But you do know a lot about Seattle.
I know one. I know two things now.
I learned today that you are a Frasier superfan.
I have seen every episode of Frasier.
So why?
First of all, how dare you? That is an excellent show. That is prestige television. Like, you know, go fuck yourself with The Sopranos and all that garbage. I would watch Frasier for the rest of my life. Excellent plots, really bad acting, everyone's white. It's exactly what I want. But I was raised by TV, and so the block on Thursdays was, I think it was Seinfeld, Friends, Frasier. And my dad would just sort of sit with me, and that's what we'd watch. So I've seen every episode, and I showed up, and I was like, okay, where's his apartment? Like, there's no sign.
I am so sorry to tell you this.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure that they made that show in Los Angeles.
I will leave. Like, I will leave the city.
Okay, how about this? How about, I can't say it.
I've ruined it.
No, it's fine. How about fuck, marry, kill?
Oh, my God.
Frasier.
Yeah.
Niles. And the dad.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the dog, and I got really stressed out.
Did you hear? I paused for like a
second. Because I was like, God, that's tough. I mean, I do a lot to the dog, so I don't really know. That joke did not land with you guys. You're very sensitive about that dog. What was it? Fraser, Niles, and the... What was the dad's name?
John.
What was it? Martins. That lady knows.
Wow.
I would marry Niles, because he seems very pliant.
Clearly.
I would kill Fraser because he sucks. And then I would go to town on the dad.
Yeah. Really.
Give him the best five minutes of his life. Yeah. That's me being generous, by the way.
All right. So, I wanted to talk to you about, I first became aware of you when you posted a very rude thing on Twitter. suggesting that someone other than a white man should have a job.
Yeah.
So that was out of line.
You know what? It went really well. And I never faced any consequences whatsoever for that.
Congrats.
And everyone was like, you know what? I agree. And then I won the Priest Prize.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
I feel like we should, instead of, as much as I would love to just talk,
we should probably tell them what I said.
You want to give people some background on your cool life?
So this was 2 years ago. But we're still talking about it because it's like a thing.
Sorry,
that no, it's not your fault. No, it's like a. It's like honestly, like
I love it when white men are horrible. I really want to talk to you about it.
Truly, it's so my. This is what I have instead of pie. I just eat white men. But I was working as an editor at the time, and I was looking for writers for the publication I was working for, and I tweeted that I was looking for primarily people who are non-white and non-male. And so then everyone was like, white genocide, I don't like that. And then it kind of went away from there, and I had no control over it, and I'm still talking about it.
I mean, I was refreshing my memory on the kerfuffle.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, you didn't even say, white men not allowed to email me.
You know what my favorite one was when I sent that tweet, somebody replied with a photo that of, like an old, I don't know, an old photo of, I guess, an employment posting that said no Irish. And I was like,
yes,
that is the same thing. I'm so glad you told me. Great, we agree.
Seriously though, so white men, what are we gonna do? Like, what do we do with them?
I don't know,
what?
Man. I don't know.
And I mean that sounds like a joke question, but seriously though, like what, like everything's broken. White male mediocrity has seized the throat of Earth and is just ripping it out. So what are we going to do?
I feel like it's evolving into this new kind of monstrosity now where, like, first they're just bad. Like, they're just bad. And then they go to, like, this sort of fake wokeness where they think that they've got all the answers and then they start condescending to you. That's where I live now. I got a lot of white dudes who want to be like, you know what? I just think people would appreciate your message if you were kinder. And it's like, you know what? I also agree. Please climb up my butthole. It's very warm there.
You'll love it.
You'll love it.
See, how is that not kind?
I don't know. I said, you please climb up my butthole. I mean, I didn't like, you don't have to do it, but I thought it was like a polite offering.
I just don't know, like, what we're supposed to do. Because clearly, you know, disparities in race and gender are killing us all. But you're not allowed to even say, hey, maybe my little website could publish, like, some funny stories about the life of, I mean...
Or literally anything.
So you can't address it sort of broadly. You can't be whiteness seems to be a problem because people lose their minds.
Uh-huh.
And you can't address it proactively. Like, okay, well, I'm going to use my position to try to elevate the voices of maybe some people who don't usually get heard. If you get exasperated and you are a little bit honest, then people are like,
not my cup of tea.
Yeah, well, I would be against racism, but...
But you're so mean.
You're a little abrasive. So, yeah. Where are we? Where do we end up? What do we do?
I don't know, man. Like, the discourse here is so fucking weird. Like, I was watching all day today, people were upset that, I think it was like Hillary Clinton wouldn't take enough credit for losing the election. Like, everyone was talking about that today online. And it's like, okay, yeah, she lost, but is this really what you want to fucking talk about? Like, it's been a while. I don't know how to make people examine their own garbage. I feel like it is going to be my life's work.
Yeah.
But I'm really not sure. I'm really not sure. I feel like I convert one dum-dum every 5 months, which is not a very average.
Yeah, I know. I feel the same way. It's like, because you can get through to people if you just say the same thing over and over again 10,000 times.
Over and over again. Yeah. And then they email you and you answer it and then they email back. Yeah, see, I got in a trap where I was answering emails that I was getting because some of them did change their minds just because they're so terrified that you're real and that you've answered the email. And they're like, oh, God, it has breasts. And then they panic and then, like, it's a whole thing.
That's actually true.
Yeah.
So... as a person who has, like me and like any other woman or person of color, or you know, any marginalized person who works in the media or exists or has a Twitter account, you have experienced a lot, a high volume.
That's such a long list of, like, yeah. Here are all the ways you're gonna die.
Well, and you know what? It's just another. Am I allowed to swear? We're not like.
Oh,
live
I already
on
did.
Radio,
I mean,
right?
I don't okay. know.
It's just
Wait,
another
can we
fucking
not?
Way that we have to dance around. Shitty straight, like, don't say shitty straight white dude.
Not all of us.
Sorry, I'm sorry for, I mean, like, I'm not sorry because you, it's important.
Some of us planted a tree this weekend.
Some of us what?
This is a dumb joke. I don't want to say it again now.
I failed all, I did, that was
fine.
Really bad
it.
Of
you
me
took it
as
away.
Moderator okay. to talk over your joke. but anyway, so you've experienced a high volume of Twitter harassment, and then, by extension, this is the same for me. Like, I've spent the last 5 years, like, writing about Twitter. Like, that's my job now. Have you experienced that same thing? Like, I feel really resentful that that Twitter and the internet in general have become my beat. Because, like, that's not one of my interests. Like, I barely like the internet. And I have to do interviews about it. I have to, like, people are like, so, Lindy, how can we re-engineer Twitter using code of computer code? Like, I don't know. Like, what do we do to fix Twitter? So I guess my question is, have you had that same experience? And also, like, what would you rather be talking about? Like, what actually interests you?
Okay, well, I don't know if you knew this, but I'm the Canadian you.
Really?
Yeah.
That's, like, so flattering to
no,
me.
No, it's not.
Oh.
You don't want that.
Why?
You don't want that life. But it's because, like, so Canada's not very big. First of all, we all say Canada like it's, like, one big town. But Toronto, which is a city, if you don't know that, I know you guys don't learn a lot about us, right up there, there's not a lot of people. It's 35 million people. And you guys have, like, what, 350? Jesus Christ, that's too much. But anyway, look, I mean, it's so small. So then what ends up happening is something happens to anybody and it becomes sort of the only thing that we can talk about. And we also don't think, like, we need to find any other people for it. So this also happens in terms of, like, diversity hiring in Canada, especially in media, is they're like, we got one brown lady. End of list.
Oh, yeah.
End of list.
Do you want to talk about that thing that happened recently with the...
I sure can.
Please.
There's a thing that happened, I think it's about 2 weeks ago now, where a bunch of very prominent, high-level media editors and executives were tweeting about how they were going to put together a collection plate of sort. They were going to gather money for an appropriation prize. So it would be who could best culturally appropriate in their writing. They did this at 11:45 on a Thursday night, when I guess they thought we were all sleeping? Like, I don't know.
I don't think they care. The
I don't
point
think,
is
they,
that
no, they just didn't give a shit. And it was the worst, and then ever...
It was like a sarcastic backlash to legitimate criticisms of cultural appropriation.
Somebody had written for this other magazine about how he believed in an appropriation prize. It was very dumb. And it was so dumb that he quit. Because he knew it was stupid. So then all these ding-dongs were like, I can't believe this guy got ran out. And it's like, do you understand how quitting works? Like, nobody did this to him. And then it kind of just snowballed from there and turned into like this very emblematic of what's wrong with the country.
It is. And this is, you know, less so because I'm a white lady, but I do always feel...
Congratulations on that, by the way. Sounds great.
You're welcome. what do you say to congratulations? Thank you.
Thank you.
I agree.
Yeah.
Congratulations to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always feel this... It's usually with men, I guess, because, you know, my identity is, you know, as a woman and as a feminist who writes on the internet, this is where this comes up. But I always feel, it's like you don't know who to trust. Because people like to talk a big game about being progressive and being, you know, one of the good white people and being woke or whatever. Or one of the good men, you know, I support women, I have a mom, I can't.
Yeah, it's like, I've never hit my mom. You're like, cool.
When things like that happen, it makes me feel so paranoid, where it's like, all of you have been thinking this this whole time.
Yeah.
You've been holding these really important, powerful jobs, I'm sure claiming over and over again that there are no, there is no discrimination.
There's no money. There's no time.
There's no money
We have no positions. We've already filled them. There's no audience for that kind of content.
And how dare you suggest that we're prejudiced, that there's any kind of systemic discrimination going on. And then you find out, because they're, you know, they actually have such a low level comprehension of the issue that they... feel just fine, like, doing that in public on Twitter, where it can be screen grabbed forever.
Which is what I did.
By you.
But, I mean, it's, like, that was, like, a moment of, it was, like, four or five people who had, within about 50 minutes, gathered $3,500 of their personal wealth for this dumb thing. So if you can do that, why don't you give it to an indigenous person to write a thing? Like, if you are willing to throw your money around for this bullshit, I don't see why you can't actually use it for something positive.
Because they don't care.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally they raised money to give to a white person for being racist the best.
Yeah, I guess they need more.
So I guess, how do you deal with that? How do you... You don't know who to trust. Like, how do you...
I trust no one.
Right.
That's what I do. I'm very paranoid, and I'm mad all the time. It's really doing wonders for my wrinkles on the forehead. I feel really good and energized and youthful.
Don't even talk to me about wrinkles on the forehead, 26 years old. I am getting... It's fine. I'm embracing it. It's fine. I shouldn't.
Wow.
This is such a bad road to go down.
I got dark real fast.
No, I just noticed the other day that I have, like, a...
You were talking about a skincare routine recently.
Yeah,
you had changed up your
skincare
routine.
I tried to have a skincare.
It looks great. You look glowing.
Well, thank you. I haven't done it in like a month.
You
but,
look great.
I'm sure it was those 2 weeks of serums.
I look young because I'm mad.
You are young.
Yeah, but I'm not forever.
That's I did want to ask you. So when I was 26, you're 26?
Yeah.
So I
For
started,
now. For now.
For now, yeah. Don't get used to it, sweetie. 27's coming. Yeah, okay. That is actually how condescending people are when they're older.
I mean, I don't
like,
really. It's fine.
You probably don't understand about the progression of time.
I don't mind it because I feel like then I can do it later. I'll take it. I'll bank it for later.
But I started writing professionally when I was 25. And then when I was 26, I was like writing little movie reviews and like little theater reviews in the local paper. It was a great job. But it's like, looking back on it, it is mortifying because I wrote things that were very bad. And I can look back and I can see myself growing up on the page in public, in print forever, and on the internet like double forever. And I'm so jealous of you. Like you're so poised and your writing is so mature and beautiful and smart, and I was just wondering how you did that. like, are you, do you have the same terror? Because, like, I'm terrified that people.
I mean, I had, like, a really upsetting childhood, and it made me an adult quickly.
Oh, congratulations.
Is that, thank you. No, I don't know. I mean, like, I think there's lots of stuff that I wrote that is embarrassing and bad. Like, I did, like, even on just a small level, like, I did a search on my own Facebook for, like, different words I might have used when I was younger. Because I got, this is the other problem, I got Facebook when I was, like, 15. That's bad. That's a bad thing. And so I went searching, and I just looked up my name and the word retarded. What the fuck was I doing? Because you're 15, and you don't know, and you say these dumb things, and it was just riddled with that. And I had that anxiety of, like, what did I write? Like, what did I write? And I started writing for money at, there was a, in the province I grew up in, provinces are like states. There's like a governmental body that handles them. There's I don't know how many provinces there are. That's not good. Don't tell the consulate. But there was like a magazine that published the work of basically mostly teenagers, teenage girls. And so I started working for them when I was 14. I am terrified of the stuff that will, if they ever like have an archive, I'm doomed. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it's sort of part of it, but I guess maybe the measurement is to make sure that you're still trying.
Yeah.
And that if it does sort of resurface that you're like, yikes, okay, well, I don't do that anymore. And I recognize why, and this is why that was wrong.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Sachi Kuhl read from her work and spoke to Lindy West at Seattle Public Library's Central Library on May 31st. Tune in again soon.